Good afternoon. So as you know, I've just returned from overseas where I visited Vietnam before attending APEC and the East Asian Summit in the Philippines and Malaysia. I was pleased we were able to expand our relationship with Vietnam. New Zealand has a lot to offer Vietnam. It was good to discuss further trade and investment opportunities which will offer huge potential to both countries. APEC and East Asian Summit provided a number of opportunities for me to meet with other leaders and to discuss a wide range of economic, social and security issues, as you would expect. As you know, my return to New Zealand is unfortunately a short one. On Wednesday, I'm heading to CHOGM, Commonwealth Heads of Government in Malta, and then on to Paris for the United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP21, and then to Berlin to see Angela Merkel. In terms of the Climate Change Conference, New Zealand will be pushing for a deal that puts the world on a pathway towards limiting global temperature rise to no more than 2%. While New Zealand's emissions are small on a global scale, we are determined to make a fair and ambitious contribution to the international effort. I'll be making a couple of announcements on in Paris on new initiatives to help reduce global emissions. Excuse me. Today we confirm we're on track to help thousands more New Zealanders into their first home. You'll recall that the government doubled support for first home buyers from 1 April this year through the new KiwiSaver Home Start program. Couples buying a newly built home can now receive grants of up to $20,000, and those buying an existing home can get up to $10,000. The new $435 million scheme is expected to help around about 90,000 Kiwis into their first home over the next 5 years. Nick Smith this afternoon issued figures confirming that we're on our way towards achieving that ambitious target. Almost 6,300 Home Start grants were approved for the first home buyers in the 6 months to the 3rd of September. That's more than 70% higher than the 3,600 approvals under the old scheme in the previous 6 months. In addition, there were about 2,500 pre-approved grants in the scheme. In total, the government paid out over $24 million in Home Start grants during 6 months to September. As the figures show, these grants help first-home buyers right across New Zealand, not just in the main cities. So this expanded scheme is delivering on its goal of helping thousands of New Zealanders into their first home. The Home Start grants are just one way the government is helping first-home buyers. Under new rules from 1 April this year, first-home buyers can withdraw almost all of their KiwiSaver funds and put it towards their home deposit. We've also expanded eligibility for the Welcome Home Loans, which help first-home buyers with only a 10% deposit. In the 6 months to September, nearly 1,200 new Welcome Home Loans were approved. One of our main priorities is increasing the supply of land for housing. We're freeing up more land through our 8 housing accords and special housing areas across the country. Dr. Smith and Auckland and the Auckland Mayor today confirmed another 9 special housing areas, which will provide another 1,100 new homes across Auckland. This takes the total number of special housing areas in Auckland to 106, with the potential for more than 48,000 new homes. We've also taken steps to constrain building material costs, cut compliance costs, and improve building sector productivity. New tax measures took place from 1 October this year to ensure people who invest in housing for profit pay their fair share of tax, so the government is continuing to work hard on many fronts to help first home buyers. You will have seen we've announced a public memorial service to be held to remember All Black great Jonah Lomu at Eden Park on Monday. This service will be a public celebration of Jonah's life and the contribution he made to rugby and the numerous charities he was involved with. In addition, there will also be a Pacifica event at the Vodafone Events Centre on Saturday from midday. Once again, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the tremendous contribution Jonah made to rugby, his community and to New Zealand, and to offer my condolences to Nadine and Jonah's family. In terms of my activities this week, I'm in Auckland tomorrow and Wednesday before heading out overseas. I don't have a huge amount of time today because I'm catching a flight, but I've got some time.
Prime Minister, do you need to now put in place some controls on immigration, given the numbers today, 62,500 net? That's putting huge pressure on those Auckland houses that you're talking about.
Well, I think it makes sense always to review who's coming in and why, and to consider what options are available. So I'd make a few points. Firstly, today in a way is a day of great celebration because more on a net basis, people came from Australia to live in New Zealand over the last 12 months than New Zealanders that left to go to Australia. And that used to be around about 35,000, 40,000 Kiwis net were going to live in Australia. What it shows you is we're doing something right in this country. Secondly, if you look at that number, 62,500 net, it's made up of about 120,000 arrivals. Now, if you look at those arrivals, there's a sort of groups that they're made up of. So, for instance, of them, 27,500 of the 120,000 are students coming here. That's an export education business, if you like, that's worth about $3 billion.
Labor says that it would consider perhaps changing the rules around student visas, particularly because they can work 20 hours a week.
They can.
And we're in an environment where the unemployment rate's going up.
Yeah, but for a start off, we make $3 billion out of that industry. That cross-subsidise a lot of education for other New Zealanders. It's great for those institutions. It employs a lot of people that would otherwise not be employed. And yep, some of those young people who come and study in New Zealand do go and work 20 hours a week. Often they're in reasonably unskilled jobs in a lot of cases. They do make a contribution to New Zealand. Actually, we want them in a lot of instances. And our unemployment numbers, you know, they move around for a lot of reasons, but as I said before, we have very high levels of participation in the economy. So that's one thing. The second thing is, of the 120,000, 30,000 were New Zealanders returning from Australia to New Zealand. So if you consider that of the net migration numbers, some we wouldn't want to control. Student numbers I actually think are really important because we're making money out of them. Kiwis coming home, we can't control. Australians coming across the Tasman, we can't control because of the free labour market. Many that come from the Pacific, we don't control because we have in any great way, because we have a system for that. You're really starting to say who's coming in under the skilled category and who's coming in under the investor category. And in those, they add to our economy. So yes, look, we always review that. There are always some industries that we take off or add depending on the demand. But I really do think, rather than worrying about it too much, we should respond to it and clearly need to build more homes and lives, but also celebrate the fact that people want to come and live in New Zealand.
But can the infrastructure in Auckland in particular handle this record high net migration? We've seen record high house prices.
Well, it's already starting to respond dramatically. So you've seen the amount of consenting, the amount of building activity rising rapidly and likely to rise even further. I mean, again, that's employing a huge number of people in the Auckland area. Now, if you're a builder in Auckland, you're busy.
But the Reserve Bank Governor pointed out last week that even the extra houses that are being built is not enough to cope with the migrants coming.
Yeah, depends. It depends on where people are going and what they're doing. I suspect a whole lot of students that come here either don't buy a house or may alternatively be buying an apartment. So yes, we need to build more apartments, but you know, there's various parts of the demand curve. We are rapidly increasing the amount of housing that we're building, and as Christchurch showed us, when we get that into equilibrium, house prices do stop rising.
Are you worried, you know, you seem to have done a lot of breaking down the numbers here. Are you worried that there is going to be a backlash, that the public might start to say, hey, we're not that keen on this number of migrants?
Well, I think it's really important people understand what's happening. You've got a lot of returning Kiwis, you've got some Australians coming across the Tasman, you've got a huge number of people coming here to study. I mean, all of those things are either things that we can't control, wouldn't want to control, or things we should celebrate. On top of all of that, you do get people coming in who are just adding to our economy. They come in the investor category and the high school category. And look, overall, the alternative to this is net migration, showing huge numbers of people leaving our country. Show me a country which is booming around the world where more people leave it than come to it. The answer is New Zealand is highly placed as a destination that people want to come and live in. Why? Because in a very troubled international environment, as you've seen with the attacks in Paris and the likes, we're seen as safe in a place where our environment, for the most part, is pretty clean.
But you're making
We've got a growing economy.
A trade-off, though, with unemployment.
Well, I wouldn't get too head up on that. I mean, our unemployment rate's broadly about the same rate as Australia, but our participation rate is much higher. The reduction in employment in the last quarter, the quarterly numbers bounce around a lot, was all around part-time employment. It's a bit seasonal.
So you don't think the unemployment rate will continue to increase?
Well, no, I can't say that, because, I mean, there's a variety of different bank and treasury forecasts which show it might move around a bit, but the longer-term numbers are still lower. Of course, we'd like the headline rate a little bit lower, but we do have very high levels of participation. the economy is generating a lot of jobs. I think it generated 190,000 jobs in the last 3 years from memory.
On the housing service, can I just ask, have you any more details on the Lomu service? How many people are expected, the shape it might take, the involvement of the family?
So the service is, the primary service on the Monday at Eden Park will run from between 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock. I really don't know how many people would turn up, but my expectation is it will be tens of thousands. I mean, I think Jonah was much loved. There'll be a huge number of people who want to come along and pay tribute to him. It's being organised essentially by the family, led, I think, by John Hart. So there'll be a range of speakers. I'm unfortunately overseas, but I'm just going to go in the moment actually and pre-record a message for that because I wanted to offer a personal message to the family and to pay my respects to Jonah. Largely the costs are paid for by the government, so the Auckland Eden Park Trust Board, I understand, is giving the venue. There'll be some clean-up and other costs that we might pick up. We don't know exactly how much it will cost for the government contribution for what is effectively the memorial services, but it's a combination of some catering at the event that will be at the Vodafone Event Centre and the other costs like stages and things. But I'd put it in the order of sort of hundreds of thousands. That's a likely advice. Probably not more than 300, but probably more than 150, and it's in that category.
On housing, does the government support that Auckland Council's moves to change the zoning rules to make Auckland Isthmus, the central area, much more dense, more apartments, more townhouses?
Well, it's going through a process, but for the most part, yes, it's clear, I think, for everyone to see that the city needs to go out and it needs to go up. Part of the reason why we support, for instance, the CBD rail tunnel is because that's likely to be a way of actually allowing intensification in the CBD. And development in the CBD is much less controversial than it is in other parts. So everyone knows the points where there's a degree of either pushback, concern, or nimbyism, you can call it whatever you like. But within the CBD area and in other parts of Auckland, there's not much pushback when it comes to apartments.
But in the leafy areas around the CBD, the Remuera's, the Parnell's, the Mount Evans, is the government in favour or supporting the council's move to increase density?
It's on a case-by-case basis, and it depends. I mean, Remuera's actually had quite a lot of apartment building. Parnell's, you probably know, I think is the densest suburb in Auckland, actually. It's pretty dense in Auckland. The Parnell area from a housing perspective. So, look, it just depends on what they're building and where.
Do you expect the deal that comes out of Paris to actually make a difference to climate change?
Yes, I think it'll definitely make a difference. So, I went to Copenhagen, as you'll remember, and when we went there, there was no agreement, there was no communique. If you're going to a conference like that and expecting leaders to sort of nut out a communique on the floor, it's never going to happen. My sense of what's happening in Paris is there's a much greater alignment. When I was at APEC and East Asian Summit, leaders talked about quite a great deal with President Obama. I think over 150 countries are going with their own individual target. What won't happen is you won't get some sort of legally binding agreement which will bind each country. What you will get is each country coming along and saying, this is what we propose to do. And over the next few years, the formation of the rules that those countries will have to comply with as they meet their targets. So I think collectively we are going to do a lot more. It will just take some time though.
But how can you expect it to make a difference if countries aren't bound to their targets? They can go along and be like, yeah, we'll agree to this, and then go back and do nothing.
Well, no system's perfect. So we saw with Kyoto, when people were theoretically bound, Canada pulled out of it. Some countries brought in all these AAUs, which were essentially cheap and free emissions. So from sort of developing Russian states. I mean, there's a whole, it's never a perfect system. I think what you are seeing, though, is an acceptance by a wide array of countries now, though, that climate change needs to be dealt with. And I think one of the catalysts for changing that sentiment was the deal that President Xi Jinping from China managed to nut out with President Obama. That happened after the G20 was hosted APEC was hosted in China, and I think that was really important. So you're always going to have some countries that are going to come along, particularly developing countries, and say it's not fair, we shouldn't have to comply. I don't think it'll be absolutely plain sailing in Paris, but I do think you're going to get progress.
Just to
on the Fox Mercy Fresh on Saturday, do you expect to, that that will have an impact on the wider tourism industry?
Certainly hope not. I mean, the tourism numbers today showed how strong they were, well over 3 million arrivals now. For the most part, we've got a pretty good record when it comes to aviation. We've had some accidents. You obviously had the tragedy of Fox Glacier, which was the skydiving accident some years ago that actually affected the day of the first crash, actually, in Quaife. In the end, that turned out to be an issue with the plane actually, as opposed to skydiving itself. From time to time, you've had helicopter accidents, but for the most part, if people look at these matters, they'll see that, A, we've made significant changes in recent times around adventure tourism to try and make that industry safer. Something like helicopter trips was already covered under the civil aviation rules, as is some activity on the water is already existing rules around Maritime New Zealand cover up. But for the most part, I think people probably say, look, there are helicopter accidents around the world that happen. New Zealand takes these issues seriously and hopefully it won't put them off.
There was some tightening up. Do you think those regulations have gone far enough in terms of the onus on providing?
But in relation to adventure tourism, there's been a reasonably dramatic change because so many parts of the industry weren't regulated. They didn't have audits. There weren't the requirements that are on them now and the oversight of that by WorkSafe New Zealand. When it comes to helicopters trips, they already were covered and there were changes as a result of what took place in terms of the aviation changes, as I understand it. So I think what will happen here is there'll be the full investigation by TAC. They'll come away and eventually tell us what went wrong and why, and whether there's any learnings to come out of that.
There has been criticism to TAC previously in terms of the handling of the skydiving helicopters.
Yep.
Do you have faith in them to carry out that investigation?
I do. I mean, in so much I didn't do the work. I know there was criticism of the carbon balloon or the Fox Glacier skydiving accident, and they went away. But I think Craig Foss actually had a look at that and was satisfied actually with the change the outcome recommendations from that. But TAC, I think, is seen as a good institution. It's got the resources that needs to now go in.
What do you think of Andrew Little heading over to Canberra to speak to Australian politicians and select committees about the rights of Kiwis living over there? Do you think he can make a difference that you haven't through your chapter talks?
I reckon he's 14 years too late. He should have gone with his Prime Minister in 2001, not put us in that position. But putting that to one side, look, I've been saying to journalists for some time, you guys are aware of that, we are working on this issue of pathway to citizenship. Malcolm Turnbull seems sympathetic to what we're saying. Certainly Tony Abbott was becoming more sympathetic to the issue. I reckon we're going to see some progress. I certainly hope Andrew Little doesn't make things worse, because quite frankly, actually, I'm being stupid about it, but there's movement in the Australian system, but the more they highlight that to Australian MPs, the more pushback you might get, not support. So I think there is a growing acceptance in the Australian system, because I've raised it with Brooke Shorten, who's the Labor leader in Australia. Certainly constantly raised it with the Australian Prime Ministers of the day. There's an acceptance that they just can't carry on the way they are with such a large group of people who effectively don't have a pathway to becoming an Australian citizen. It doesn't seem right to me.
Can you explain what the pathway might be? Is
the pathway lower costs for citizenship? Is it specifically for New Zealanders? Is that what you envisage?
Well, it's certainly only specific in New Zealand, because you've got to remember we're the only people who have the freedom across into the Australian labour market without actually having this type of, with access to this type of visa, so it's specific to New Zealand. In terms of, it's not a cost issue, it's actually a rights issue. So it's that these people have no right, despite what they do over a long period of time, to actually qualify to become a resident, to ultimately become a citizen. So it's a pathway issue. The challenge for Australia is the fiscal cost. So there's no question there's a fiscal cost here. And the question would be, if they're prepared to change, where do they draw the line? And that's what we've been talking to them about. I don't want to promise it because I just can't force them. But nothing Andrew Little's doing is going to help. What will help will be if Malcolm Turnbull makes the call that he wants to put some money into this to make it happen.
And when you say draw the line, is that a time question, or is it the type of citizens they are? What do you mean by draw the line?
Well, there's three, I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to say there's 300,000 people sitting in this category. There's a large number, it's in the hundreds of thousands. So the question is, where do they say all of them? Do they say none of them? Do they say if they've been here a certain period of time? There's many ways you can, you know, kind of slice the onion. It's a question of where you decide, or where they might decide, would be acceptable to give people a chance to have, you know, realistically become an Australian resident, therefore a citizen.
Can you explain how Andrew Little might make it worse by going to speak to the selectmen?
Well, because it's not exactly that the rules that apply in Australia are popular in Australia. I know we are offended by it. It's like the deportation issue. On the other side of the Tasman, it gets widespread support.
So how would that make it worse, though? You're saying that they might change the rules? Or?
Well, because if he goes over there and starts telling a whole bunch of MPs that, you know, demands change, one of the risks you get is that I think you just get more pushback, because in the end it highlights the issue, it just encourages everyone to go down another path by looking what the cost would be, what it would ultimately mean. There's a degree of diplomacy about this stuff that we can get progress if we're prepared to work behind the scenes, in my view.
Do you think Australians don't want New Zealanders to become citizens?
No, but they're quite happy. You know what I mean? They're quite happy with the current set of rules. They're not affected by them.
The NZCPR's taken out four-page ads about Māori and the government working behind closed doors to hand over water rights. Is that accurate, and do they have a legitimate concern?
No, no.
Do you have a view on that style of advertising?
That's a stunt.
Timor-Leste is apparently in trouble economically. Is that disappointing, given how much New Zealand put into it?
I wouldn't completely jump to that conclusion. I know they've been working pretty hard to diversify their economy. They've got a petroleum fund, I think, you know, that's been running down. They've certainly been spending more, but that's not unique. I mean, there's quite a lot of countries in Saudi Arabia at the moment are spending a lot more than it's actually earning. We need to continue to work with them as best we can to allow them to diversify their economy. I think there's still, you know, well over, I think it's a bit about $17 billion in that fund, so I don't think they've broken yet, but they are certainly spending more than they're earning, and that's a matter of, ultimately a matter they'll need to think, you know, long and hard about how they diversify even further in their economy. But quite a bit of work's been happening in that space.
Does New Zealand still give aid?
Yeah, we give $44 million over the last 3 years, or the next 3 years, from 15-16 out to 17-18.
And there are more deportees due from Australia sometime this week. Do you have any more details?
I saw a note when I was on the plane last night saying there's more coming, but it didn't actually specify the number, so I don't know.
How's Murray McCulley going? How's Murray McCulley going?
Recovering right now. I've been in text sort of exchange with him a little bit recently, and I'm due to give him a call tonight, so I was planning to do that. But I think he's recovering strongly.
When are you likely to make a decision on who's going to replace Mike Murray?
By Christmas.
And will that mean that you have to reshuffle the ministry?
Depends on who we select.
Don't give too much away.
No.